triomphe sprint, Bennett est en deuxième position. Brian Cocker à la troisième place. Le sprint ici sur la promenade des Anglais. Le final avec Kisbol peut-être. Kisbol face à Alexander Christophe. Et le succès peut-être. Attention, les tout derniers mètres. La victoire pour Alexander Christophe qui remporte l'étape ici sur la promenade des Anglais. Quatrième victoire d'étape en carrière sur le Tour de France. Alexander Christophe, l'ancien champion d'Europe.
You are listening to the cycling podcast at the Tour de France, brought to you by iWoka, flexible loans built for small businesses, iwoka.co.uk. Today, we're in Nice.
I think we're ready to go, guys, with the first Tour de France podcast of the 2020 Tour de France.
Whoa. Woo! Oh my God,
here we are. Well, we're in Nice. My name's Richard Moore. That is Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
That is Lionel Burney across the table from me. And we are joined once again. Bienvenue, François Thomazeau.
Bienvenue. Well, thank you very much. I see your French is improving fast, Richard.
Coming from a low base, François. Just a local race for you, this. You're just coming along the coast for the start of the Tour de France this year?
Yeah, well, local, you know, don't tell Marseillais that.
I know,
you know,
this
Nice
is what I was hoping to provoke.
There's always been a rivalry. I mean, we're in the same region, and obviously Marseille is the capital of the region, and Nice is only kind of a remote suburb. So
I don't think that's what the Niçois say.
No, of course they. Yeah, I mean, there was actually for a long time a big rivalry and dispute between Nice and Marseille over the regional, dominance.
Well, am I right in thinking that it's a bit like the Edinburgh-Glasgow rivalry, that Marseille is Glasgow, it's gritty, it's industrial, it's a bit more real. Edinburgh's kind of all fur coat and nay knickers, as they say in Scotland.
I mean, we've been there. Actually, Nice was founded by the Greeks from Marseille. So we created this town, you know, 600 years before Christ. So I mean, you know, there are about a million inhabitants in Marseille, and I don't know that there must be about 250 in Nice. So I mean, you know,
250,000. That
end
would
of
be
the match. There's no match actually.
Well, Nice has the salad niçoise, which I had for lunch, François. I mean, not
really. How
does
it compare to the salad marseillaise?
Well, I was going to say, it doesn't compare to bouillabaisse very well, really. I mean, I'd much rather have a hearty bowl of bouillabaisse fish stew than a salad niçoise. But it was a nice one. It was a tuna and boiled egg and tomato and olives. And
you know, one of the essential fixtures of a salad niçoise, nothing in it should be cooked. So everything should be raw. So normally you have raw tuna, you have raw salad, raw tomato, everything. Even boiled eggs are kind of disputed, you know.
Well, so. I was going to say, this is kind of a home fixture for Team Ineos in a way, isn't it? Because Jim Ratcliffe owns...
Not the correct team name there, Lionel. Oh. An early
klaxon.
Yeah.
Ineos Grenadiers. I think we should have some kind of marching band music every time we say Grenadiers, maybe. I don't know. But the Jim Ratcliffe and co, Ineos own the Nice Football Club, who play at the Allianz Arena now, out just outside of town. They used to have a lovely little stadium in the city, didn't
that's
they?
Right, the Stade du Rail.
That's it, right in the city. Now they've moved out to a fancy new place. But
3 minutes into our Tour de France coverage, and we've done football and food already. People
that's
are
right.
turning off in their droves.
Well, let's go all the way down this road and saying, you know what the Nice club are called by fans? They're Le Gym, because they're called Olympic Gymnastic Club of Nice.
Not so after Jim Ratcliffe.
Yeah, well, mind you. I'm sure that's probably why he bought the club.
Just scrolling back a bit, I was only joking about Edinburgh being founded by the Greeks, but there's an Acropolis. Anyway, moving on, there was a stage of the Tour de France today, and there was also La Course, which I went to in the morning. So a double header on day one of a very unusual and strange Tour de France. We arrived in Nice, all three of us, yesterday. And we're sort of getting to grips with how this Tour de France is going to be this year. It's not going to be like other Tours de France. But, well, not only that, but we had weather to contend with today as well. Rainstorms turned the roads pretty treacherous. Luke Rowe, who lives near here, said that it hasn't rained here for months and that was a factor. Ian Boswell actually said the olive trees and their spillage might have also made the roads greasier, but there was some talk of oil being on the roads and a lot of crash victims today.
Is that a setup for the first tail of the attack of the 2020 Tour de France?
I think it might be, Lionel. Okay. I don't know. I'm winging it.
Okay, well, stage one. From Nice to Nice, 156 kilometres. A short one, wasn't it? There were a couple of little climbs, nowhere near as significant as the climbs that they'll go over tomorrow. And it all was kind of so-so for the opening day of the Tour de France. As expected, a small, manageable group of three riders went away. Mikel Scher of Team CCC, Fabien Grelier of Total Direct Energy, and Cyril Gauthier of B&B Hotels. They went away, got a decent gap early on. It never looked like the sort of break that was going to trouble anyone. We were all anticipating a full-on and furious race over the hills and down into Nice onto the Promenade des Anglais, but there was carnage, wasn't there? Especially once the rain started to fall and turned the roads to glass, really. Lots and lots of crashes. I mean, it'd be easier to name the riders who didn't come down, but among the...
Go on, then.
Among the big-name riders to go down one way or another, Sam Bennett, Julian Alaphilippe, I think, went down. Pavel Sivakov went down a couple of times and looks to have come off worse for Team Ineos Grenadiers. That's not going to catch on, is it? Le gym. And even though Scher and Gauthier were the last two men standing after Grelier had kind of done his job, he got hold of the polka dot jersey, so he dropped off before the other two. Scher tried to evade capture a little bit longer, but the whole peloton came back together. But even at that point, there were riders that were out of the back chasing back on. Julian Alaphilippe was off the back. Caleb Ewan was off the back. Giacomo Nizzolo was off the back as well, who was one of the riders I had fancied for today's sprint. And then Tony Martin came to the front and did his best Fabian Cancellara impression, arms out, urging the peloton to go slowly because the descents were really treacherous. Astana didn't fancy that. They pushed on a descent and on a very gentle bend, Miguel Angel Lopez. Superman had a less than super moment, didn't he? He skidded out and, well, slipped straight into a road sign and the hedge. Fortunately, not injured, we don't think. But that persuaded Astana that perhaps a sensible tactic was to call a truce across the peloton. And then really they trundled along. And even going at a very slow pace, there were moments where riders were in difficulty. We saw George Bennett come down. He fell like a dead weight on another corner that was obviously very slippery. And then it picked up with around 10 kilometres to go. And there was a broadly speaking, a proper sprint finish. And the stage winner was Alexander Kristoff, who took his fourth stage win in his Tour de France career, two in 2014. He last won on the Champs-Élysées in 2018. And he won ahead of the world champion Mads Pedersen. All of the favourites were given the same time, no matter what grief they came to. Thibaut Pinot was probably the highest profile rider to crash in the final 3 kilometres. We'll try to find out whether, I think, Francois, you put in a call to see how Pinot is doing this evening. And, well, they all crossed the line and were given the same time, other than Pavel Sivakov, really. 13 minutes down, a very tough introduction to the Tour de France for the Tour debutant. John Degenkolb has finished outside the time limit. Rafa Valls of Bahrain McLaren is on his way to hospital and may or may not start tomorrow. But an eventful day on the Tour de France, despite probably an hour and a half of no racing in the middle of it.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns. And scaling new height with iWalker. If you run a small business, find out more at iwalker.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
Thank you very much to our title sponsor, iWalker. Their first Grand Tour supporting the Cycling Podcast, first real Grand Tour. They supported us during our Giro, of course, but the first one where we're on the road. And we're very grateful to them for their support. If you want to find out more about iWalker, and if you run a small business and you're interested in finding out more about iWalker, go to iWalker.co.uk. iWalker have been very keen on the good causes that we would support this Tour de France, and interested in being involved in that and maybe helping with the fundraising too. And one they were particularly interested in was the Joyriders, and they will be supported by us, one of two good causes, through the sales of Stacey Snyder's beautiful cups and mugs. The first batch of those went on sale today and sold out, as they always do, very quickly. But she will do a second batch, and we'll let you know when they will be on sale. But we're raising money for the Joyriders, which is a London-based organisation empowering women through cycling, with an emphasis on promoting cycling to women from a Muslim background. You can find out more about them at joyriderslondon.org. And Pichuns, is that correct pronunciation, Francois?
Yeah, Pichun. It means small guys. I mean, Pichun means small in Provençal, you know.
So. Well, Pichun is an organization we're quite familiar with, because they send young people every year to the Tour de France. They come from Bagatelle, an area of Toulouse that's not prosperous, I think it's fair to say.
No, yeah, you can say that, absolutely.
It's quite a deprived area, and the organization Pichun enables young people to discover the world of journalism through sport, in particular the Tour de France. So they send a group every year, and last year the Tour sort of acknowledged the association with a stage that started from Bagatelle. Normally, Tour stages start in the best parts of town. This was a bit different. So we're delighted to support Pichun as well, and we'll be speaking to some of them over the next couple of days, and we'll hear from them in the podcast. Now, one thing that we're doing on this Tour de France is, we've asked quite a few riders to keep audio diaries. They are Nikias Arndt of Team Sunweb, Sam Bewley of Mitchelton Scott, Simon Geschke of CCC, Ryan Gibbons of NTT, Jens Kukeler of EF Pro Cycling, Michael Morkov, Michael Murku, of De Koenig Quickstep, Lucas Postelberger of Bora Hansgrohe, Connor Swift of Team Arkea Samsic, and Pavel Sivakov of Team Ineos Grenadiers. Also, Tom Southam, DS at EF Pro Cycling. They've been sending in audio files the last few days. We'll hear a lot of them in the Kilometre Zero episodes, which begin on Monday, and which are supported by Zwift. Thank you very much, Zwift. But we're going to hear bits of the audio diaries in these episodes too, and the man of the moment today in some respects, unfortunately, was Pavel Sivakov, who is making his debut at the Tour. Very highly rated rider. Dave Brailsford said the other day he could come back, or should come back, to the Tour one day to try and win it. He's been brilliant at sending in audio of the last few days. He had a really tough day today, two crashes, and finished 13 minutes down. But first thing he did when he got to the bus was he recorded his audio diary for us at the Cycling Podcast. And here's what he had to say.
It was, I would say, a really eventful day for me. I wouldn't wish for a worse start. It's pretty bad. I mean, the only good thing is that I'm still in the race, still fighting, and I won't give up until I can. Just my body can't, you know. I don't want to let the team down. You know, I worked so hard to be there. There is some guys that were left home as well. And I took the spot, so no, I will fight until the end, that's for sure. Two crashes today. First one, I was actually mentally fine after the first one. I thought, okay, that's how it is, let's carry on. I was in the car, just coming back to the peloton, and second crash happened. And then, yeah, you know, when I crashed there, I was like thinking a bit, what the hell am I doing here? why the hell I'm riding my bike and... why I do all this, but that's, you know, that just crossed my mind for a bit, and then I thought straight away that what I just said, you know, don't want to let the guys down, don't want to let the team down, and also, you know, personally don't want to give up. It would be really bad. I would feel really shit if I do, even worse than I am now. Like I said, yeah, some guys could have been at my spot, but here I am. Obviously, I crashed. My performance will be affected from that. That's for sure. At least for a couple days. I really hope to be back at a decent level soon. But now, I'll focus on my recovery. Try to heal up as soon as possible. I had some pretty bad hits on both hips because I crashed actually on both sides. So I think sleeping won't be really funny. Yeah, otherwise, all good for the team. Happy to see that everyone stayed safe. That's the main goal. I mean, we came here to win with Egan, and we're still in the race. Obviously, for me personally, it was a terrible, terrible day. But for the team, it was a good day for everyone else. So that's the main thing. I should now refocus. Maybe still be a bit, you know, down today. But when I wake up tomorrow, I need to be ready and ready to go for 20 days. Do my best to be there. Here it is. I have the feeling that my relation with the tour will be something, yeah, between love and hate, really. Now, for the moment, it's hate. But I'm sure will be love as well, because, to be honest, I was really surprised to have that much support on the side of the road from the French fans. So that was great. And yeah, I just, that's, you know, something else that gives you a bit more motivation. So it's going to be a relation of love and hate, that's for sure. Truly quite enjoyed, and I think was good for me as well to speak out, you know, to speak everything out.
So Pavel Sivakov there, the Russian-Frenchman, I mean, he mentioned there that he had a lot of support on the roadside from the French.
Absolutely. I mean, as you know, if
You're claiming him now, are
had
you?
Had he been in the top three, you know, in the last week, he would have been French, obviously.
All the way.
But there you are.
Well,
who
I
knows?
Think he's certainly interested in being French, I think, but he's Russian. His parents are Russian parents, both former riders. He's a great rider, but he's had a really tough day. And as he said there, a love-hate relationship with the tour. This tour is all about learning from him, but he'll have learned a lot of tough lessons today, won't he?
Yeah, I mean, the heart-rending moment was when he came back to the car after the second crash and he was thumping his handlebars and just, you know, realising the extent of the damage that he'd done. You could see his left elbow was badly cut and was pouring with blood, and to hit the ground heavily twice in pretty quick succession, wasn't it? That was probably what
and
did for him.
I mean, he hit the ground very heavily not long ago, a couple of weeks ago at the Dauphiné. Was it 2 weeks ago, or was it just a week ago? It was a week ago, wasn't it?
Yes, that's
a week ago.
That's cycling these days,
yeah,
you know?
It was a week ago, and those wounds will not have healed. He said he fell on both hips today, so he's going to have a painful few days. And, you know, a comment I've often made at the Tour is that you don't win the Tour after crashing. That's not actually true. Sometimes riders have won the Tour after crashing, but it takes it out of you and it affects your ability to recover. And, you know, a few main contenders did go down today. Not many, but Nairo Quintana went down and Thibaut Pinot went down, and he looked to have hurt himself.
Yeah, we'll get
badly
back to that, but I want to keep, you know, talking about Sivakov, because for me, his crash and Andre Amador also crashed twice. It looked a little bit like the passing of the baton, the hard way between, you know, the Ineos Grenadiers. Am I doing all right there? Yeah, and the Jumbo Visma. What can you call them? Warriors or what? You saw two of the main right-hand men to Egan Bernal crashing, and apart from that, the Ineos Grenadiers were nowhere to be seen on the stage today. And you saw the Jumbo Visma guys. Well, Josh Bennett crashed, right? But apart from that, you know, we saw Primoz Roglic went actually to talk to, you know, Omar Fraile and told him, you know, calm down, you're going down too fast. And later on, as you said, you know, in the tail of the etape, Tony Martin, you know, raised his arm like the phoenix of the peloton. And, you know, it's been a long time since we had a peloton leader. And obviously Tony Martin is now a veteran of the peloton. He's kind of taken over the role Fabian Cancellara had in the past, and his Jumbo-Visma as well. So if there was any doubt that Jumbo-Visma, you know, team Jumbo-Visma had taken over from Ineos as the team showing the way, leading the way, and if there was any doubt that there's a boss in the peloton these days, this has been, I think, you know, settled today.
It's interesting that you say that, because Tony Martin has the stature, doesn't he? He's the elder statesman, not just of the team, but of the peloton. And who would be Ineos Grenadiers? It would be Luke Rowe. And, of course, the two of them
came to blows,
in last year's tour and got disqualified, didn't they?
But it's interesting, isn't it? You know, we talked a lot about the non-selection of Chris Froome and Geraint Thomas. And it just struck me today, the symbolism of that. You know, that those two very senior riders and past winners of this race, the fact that they're missing, it doesn't just take away their previous victories, but also it affects the stature of the team in a way. It turns that team into quite a young, kind of thrusting team rather than...
Because if you take the two guys supposed to really be helping out Egan Bernal, who's what, 22 now? I mean, you've got Richard Carapaz, first Tour de France, Pavel Sivakov, first Tour de France.
And also, if Froome or Thomas went down, then the peloton pays much more attention if Andre Amador goes down. I mean, no disrespect to Amador, but that's just how the pecking order works, isn't
it?
Or indeed Sivakov, absolutely. An unfortunate day for Sivakov, but you can hear in his voice there that determination. He's got one of those precious eight spots, and he has to carry on as best he possibly can. Yeah. It's incredible, really.
What he said about not giving up because he feels like he's sitting in somebody else's saddle is brilliant. I mean, it says a lot about his mentality and what a great rider he is probably going to become one day. And who knows, he might be the next Frenchman to win the Tour. But for the time being, I mean, that was interesting, to see the pressure these young guys inside the Ineos Grenadiers are under. So maybe if we had to make a contest of the sad faces today, Sivakov was there. Thibaut Pinot, obviously,
he does sad face very well, doesn't he?
We should say, just in case any listeners are not terribly familiar, they might be joining us for the Tour de France. Inexplicable that they wouldn't listen to all of our coverage when there wasn't any racing going on. But if you are joining us for the Tour for the first time, Pavel Sivakov may be a newish name to you. I mean, he's got some pedigree, hasn't he? I mean, it's in his genes because his dad, Alexei, was a pro rider, rode for the Big Mat team, rode the Tour de France, and his mum, Alexandra Kolyaseva, was a Russian national champion and also won the Tour de l'Aude, which at the time was kind of the big French stage race.
She was a world champion as well, indeed.
And a world champion, yeah. But Sivakov was born in Italy, so I mean, you may have to share.
Yeah, but he spent all his life and childhood and everything in France, and really, and that's the odd thing. I mean, I repeat the story. It's well known to Sivakov experts, but he really wanted to ride for France. I mean, he feels French. I mean, he spent all his youth, and he speaks better French than I do with slight southeast western accent. But he was never called up or even approached by the French National Federation.
He tried to approach them recently, but Lionel thought the French Federation maybe had the fax machine turned off that day. who knows? anyway.
I was just going to say, I mean, that was a real harsh introduction to the Tour de France for Pavel Sivakov. I mean, you don't get many more brutal introductions
but
to a great race.
You know, the neutralisation happened a bit later, and had that been Chris Froome or Geraint Thomas, then the neutralisation, which was imposed by the peloton itself, might have come at that point.
I mean, what do you think when you're watching? I mean, we were watching in self-isolation, weren't we, in our respective hotel rooms, I think,
bubbles,
at that point
yeah.
of the race, in our own bubbles. When Astana pushed on, what did you make of that? I mean, we kind of know that the roads around here, there's not an awful lot of rain through the summer, and the surfaces are so nice, aren't they, when it's dry. But when a little bit of moisture falls, they suddenly become like, glass or billiard tables.
I mean, that's as we know, lots of riders live in the area and know exactly what to expect in this sort of... And especially the key today was that it was the first rain for the past 2 months. It had not rained at all for the past 2 months, meaning the tarmac, the surface of the tarmac, was full of dirt, grease, oil, petrol, all those things left by cars in the summer season. And we're in Nice, so I mean, this is kind of a touristy place, and you have lots of traffic on those roads. And all of a sudden, on top of this dirt, you have a kind of film, the first film of rain goes on top of it, and it turns it into an ice skate rink, actually, and that's what happened.
Well, I'll ask you again what you thought of Astana pushing on that tricky descent. I mean,
I was about to talk about it. I think apart from Vinokurov, who's lived in the area, I mean, probably these guys are less familiar with the terrain, and we know that Omar Fraile and probably Lopez, because he's done it in the past. He's crashed heavily in the Vuelta, remember. Are kind of reckless, maybe. Not so young for Fraile, but... And they went for it. Can you... In a way, you know, that's cycling, you know. You attack, you take risk in a descent, and in this case, you can't say, you know, Lopez is a leader. I mean, he's on his first Tour de France, but in the same time, he's going for overall victory, and he attacked on a descent. Well, in a way, fair enough, you know. So,
yeah, fair enough. But I mean, let's hear what one of our other audio diarists made of that. Lukas Postelberger, who rides for Bora Hansgrohe, former Austrian champion, of course, and stage winner on the opening day of the Giro d'Italia a couple of years ago, wore the pink jersey. He's agreed to keep an audio diary for us. And Astana's decision to push on that descent was one of the things that he talked about this evening.
Yeah, guys. First stage is done. Was a tricky one, actually. 3 months no rain in Nice. And then on the two-start rain, this means soapy, slippery roads. I underestimated it also. Crashed alone. Uphill, actually, so... It was really slippery. You saw it on television. It was crazy. Peloton decided then to go easy. Astana had a different idea. And karma, yeah, sometimes slaps you in the face. Well, we went easy and there were still several crashes in the long descent. And then also we asked the commissaires if it's possible to get the same time for everybody. Doesn't matter where, when. So there is not that big fighting in the last case. And then they made a decision with 10K to go. Okay, we give everybody the same time within 3Ks. But to be honest, yeah, there was no way out. There's gonna happen a crash if also till 3Ks, and then there happened a crash with exactly 3Ks to go. Well, this is cycling, but we could have prevented this one. One day down, 20 to come. I'll keep you updated.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That said, PK, the voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that our Tour de France coverage this year is sponsored by the next generation Watt Bike Atom.
That's right, Richard. Before the tour, I was testing out the Atom at home. And one of the big developments with this next generation model is that it's got electromagnetic resistance, which means even quicker gear changes. So if you're racing on Zwift, you can react to the attacks or make them yourself, of course. Not a position that I'm often in, as you can imagine. So I put it through its paces on the RGT cycling system. So I'm on the Paterberg course, which is, I think, about a 4.2-kilometer circuit that laps the famous climb that features in the Tour of Flanders. And the reason I've chosen this course on RGT is because obviously there's a big difference between the descent into the bottom of the Paterberg and then suddenly hitting a steep climb. I just want to see how the gears cope with that sudden adjustment. So in a couple of kilometres time, we'll be descending down towards the bottom of the Paterberg. So here we are into the bottom of the Paterberg, down the hill quickly, change a few gears, lighten the load on the legs in anticipation of the changing gradient. And now we're into the 10-11%. And I'm spinning nicely. Oh, very smooth. Almost like the real thing. Now, as well as the electromagnetic resistance system, there's also new crank sensors, which mean your data is measured 1,000 times per second. So the next generation Atom is even more accurate than the old ones. Did you know that the next generation Atom can cope with maximum power output of 2,500 watts, up from 2,000 watts on the old model?
Very, very handy for you, that, Lionel. But I'm not sure it's a feature that you're really going to be taking advantage of, is it?
Well, no, I've not quite hit 2,500 watts yet. But it's nice to have something to aim for, isn't it?
Closest you get to hitting 2,500 watts is turning on the light as you walk into your high-performance training lab. Anyway, the next generation Watt Bike Atom is now available to buy from £90 per month. See wattbike.com, that's WATTBIKE.com for details.
Well, before the Watt Bike ad there, we heard from Lucas Postelberger of Bora Hansgrohe, and I hope I'm not misinterpreting what he said there, but he seemed to be suggesting that there were discussions between the riders and the race organisers and commissaires about maybe neutralising earlier than the standard 3 kilometres. And then, of course, there was a crash at 3 kilometres.
Yeah, that actually, the rule is not so standard, because it was decided during the race by the organisers to impose the 3 kilometre rule on the stage today.
Okay. So it's a movable feast, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
But they went with the 3 kilometres, and then, of course, pretty much bang on 3 kilometres to go, there was the crash which caught Thibaut Pinot and a number of others, and Postelberger sort of saying, well, maybe if they'd had the point a little bit earlier before the sprint gets towards its final phase, maybe that crash could have been avoided. I mean, that's speculative, of course, but on a day like today when they got down more or less safely and then onto the flatter roads, it was still technical, still roundabouts to get round, still a few kind of narrowings, and the GC riders want to make sure that they're going to all be treated equally when it comes to the GC standings, and whilst the sprinters are all trying to get away.
He had a good
finish.
Line about Astana as well, didn't he? Let's not.
That was the ear-catching one, wasn't it?
There's even a question when Pinot crash happened. I asked myself whether the 3K's rule was not to blame, like you have half of the peloton suddenly on the brakes or relaxing while the others are still in action, and might there be a reason there for the crash to take place?
But if you had that, say, 10 kilometres to go, for the GC riders it would make no difference.
Absolutely.
And the sprint wouldn't be in its final phase. It would still be fairly calm and ordered at that point. But having those, I don't know, it's so difficult. I mean, back in the day there was no rule at all.
No.
And then there was the 1 kilometre rule, and now it's the 3 kilometre rule or the movable feast. So
none seems to actually work. I mean, because in the end, it's you always kind of time your the rush to get even to the 3K line is also a kind of a struggle that can be troublesome. So
riding a bike on slippy roads is inherently dangerous. I mean, George Bennett crashed quite heavily when the race was neutralised. Let's not
forget.
And
they were going at no speed.
And he seemed to hurt himself. So, it was treacherous out there, and whether it was neutralised or not, it was dangerous. And I saw some posts on social media of riders in the olden days racing on no matter what the conditions. I think it's good that the riders look after their safety, their own safety and their colleagues' safety. And it's still a spectacle. I mean, there was still a race to watch and a race to be decided. And with probably the same result whether they'd raced or not, let's face it.
Crashes are part of the sport, obviously. And moving the tour to September, I mean, I'm pretty sure, I mean, because it's once again, it hasn't rained in Nice for the past 2 months. Had the tour gone as usual in July, we wouldn't have had the same kind of race. On the finish line today, we have Christophe, who, I remember, I think his first tour win, Tour de France stage win, was in the rain in Nîmes. Pouring a terrible storm, I think it was. At least he won. I don't know if it was his first, but I mean, one of his first wins was there in the rain. We know Mats Pedersen, who came second, relishes the rain as he showed by winning the Worlds. It's funny because the final sprint, nobody expected Alexander Kristoff. I mean, the least of all myself. But the thing that happened is, if you take the favorite, Caleb Ewan, Sam Bennett was almost perfectly led out by Michael Moorcore for a while. They didn't have that extra kick because they crashed, whereas Christoph didn't crash. And in the end, all the energy you lose and you waste by crashing and trying to get back into the bunch. I mean, in the end, not the underdog, but the guy nobody expected to win. Everything was perfect for Christoph today. The conditions he relishes, and he didn't crash.
That's a very good analysis, I think, because watching Bennett, he just ran out of legs. When he had a great lead out, but he hesitated. He was hesitating. And when Morkov switched off and began to pull back a bit, you were waiting for Bennett to press the trigger, and he clearly couldn't. And when he went, but he ran out of legs before the line, and so there was clearly something affecting him. Christoph was, yeah, got it just right. And it was funny, a day that was neutralised favoured the tough guys. You know, Pedersen is one of those guys too. But earlier in the stage, when the rain was falling and everyone looked miserable, and I saw Christoph's big face up near the front of the peloton, I thought, it's a Christoph day today, it is. I just wish I'd shared that with anyone. I wish I'd said it to anyone. But in our bubbles, it's very difficult to do that, isn't it?
He's almost inheriting the kind of Andre Greipel fading force mantle, isn't he? Because I've certainly written Christoph off in the last couple of years, and then he pops up and now he's in the yellow jersey.
He's a very nice guy as well. He mentioned at the finish he's got four kids at home. Lockdown must have been challenging for old Alexander Kristoff.
Yeah, well, he probably thought about the kids, you know, wow. And when he went, and yeah. You know, only second Norwegian to all the yellow jersey, you know, after Tor
who we saw last night, what passed us last night.
Yeah, I didn't recognize him, you know.
We should set the scene a bit here. We're in a bar in Nice. We're drinking a beer. We are going to be doing wine on this tour, as we did at the Giro. We're going to have a wine of the day, although not every day. It's challenging because it was easy to drink wine in our homes during the Giro. But we'll have a wine tomorrow. The wine's once again supplied by Divine Cellars in London. And we've got a good one for tomorrow. I'm looking forward to hearing Francois's thoughts on the wine. Go to divinecellars.com, and if you go to the online shop, you'll see the cycling podcast collections as various different cases of wine if you'd like to join us on our wine tour of France. But as I say, I'm looking forward to hearing Francois's verdict on some of these wines that we'll be trying. Anything more from today? I mean, we've talked to,
well, you're talking wine, so last night we had Pinot it's true, we went to a restaurant and we had Pinot, and today, unfortunately, it was a little bit too watery for you know, vintage Pinot. But that, there you are. I mean, Thibaut, it's funny because this year we had the impression, we the French, that it might be Pinot's year. Maybe not to win the Tour, but to improve on his best result and finish second maybe. But the top three looks, and still looks actually, within reach. And the reason for it was that, you know, Is the kid in a bubble, Pinot? You know, he needs to be in a bubble to avoid viruses, you know, colds, crashes, and everything. So this year looked absolutely ideal. You know, that's the Tour in the bubble. So nothing should have happened to him. And unfortunately, as we pointed out, he crashed almost on the 3K's line, and reached the finish line 4 minutes behind the Christoph. But it doesn't matter in terms of the GC. But, I mean, the face we all saw on TV, and I know it must have broken the hearts of some of our listeners who are great Thibaut Pinot fans, but he looked miserable. He looked angry with himself, and he looked, for a minute, you know, he had this look on his face like, you know, like fate has again, you know, fallen all over me, and what am I going to do with that? And he didn't kind of display the kind of warrior or you know, fighting, you know, like, well, you know, forget it, let's go for it. He looked really miserable, and if that's the sign of his motivation for the rest of the tour, I don't know how you can read into that. But
with Pinot, you just feel everything has to go right. And I remember last year wrapping him in cotton wools too strong, but he was wrapped in a jacket every day last year at the stage finishes. The first thing they did was, you know, somebody greeted Pinot just beyond the line and put a big jacket on him, no matter how hot it was. There was this sense you had of him being protected, and everything did go right for him last year until it didn't, and it was a crash, an innocuous crash that sort of took him out in the end. But, you know, you felt like if Pinot's going to win the Tour, everything has to go right. And for him to crash, and it looked quite sore. I mean, he had some quite nasty wounds.
And it's the third time he's been crashing since the season resumed, only when? 3 weeks ago or 1 month ago. So three crashes in, you know, in such a short amount of time is not promising. So there is a positive way of saying it for Thibaut fans. It's better that he crashes on the first day within the 3K limit, then, you know, maybe later on in the tour when he's in contention for victory, or it can be an omen of, you know, worse things to happen.
Ordinarily, I'd say, yeah, okay, it's only day one, but tomorrow is such a difficult day, isn't it? It's going to be short, relatively short, intense, lots of climbing, will be explosive. You don't want to be feeling some wounds from a crash on a day like tomorrow.
Yeah. That we don't know the extent of anybody's wounds, actually, after this kind of eventful day. I've been trying to get hold of my friend Philippe Mauduit, who's the group of my FDJ team director, and we get on very well, and usually he replies, you know, straight away, and he has not been replying to my texts or my calls, so I don't know what it's the same. I don't know how to, you know, read into that. Is that
we should have signed him up as an audio diarist.
Yeah, we should have. But maybe we can. We still can. But I mean, you know, Philippe not responding could. Well, what does it mean? I mean, is he busy? You know, trying to boost Thibaut's morale, or is Thibaut bruised and he doesn't want to talk about it? I don't know. Or maybe he's just didn't get my test. But or maybe he hates me. But anyway. In terms of the GC contention, that was a major, you know, event today. So we'll see.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for supporting the Cycling Podcast. Very, very grateful to them, as ever, for their very generous support. And their support of you as well on your cycling endeavours with the discount code SISCP25. You can get 25% off at scienceandsport.com. I had an energy bake with me on my ride today, Lionel. How were you? How did you feel yourself?
I could have done with something on the Col d'Aise. We've both ridden the Col d'Aise separately today, haven't we? For an episode of Kilometre Zero. The first one goes out on Monday morning. You hear all about our battles with, what can we call it? Col de Londes, I suppose, the Irish mountain. Because
you wore an Irish jersey.
I did wear an Irish jersey. Lionel. Yeah, well, it was the famous final time trial of Paris-Nice for so long. It's kind of not the fashion now, is it, with Paris-Nice? But in the 80s, from 1981 to 1989, the Irish dominated. The final score was Sean Kelly 5, time trial wins, Stephen Roach 4. And as I rode up, I saw some graffiti on the road saying Roach, 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 Roach for Nico Roach. Mm. He'll be riding the Col d'Aise tomorrow. And Sam Bennett, I know, born in Belgium, but brought up in Carrick-on-Shore, where Sean Kelly was from, or is from. So my little homage to the Irish mountain out the back of Nice.
That'll be Kilometre Zero on Monday. Kilometre Zero on Wednesday will be a look at La Course and the proposed new stage race for women starting in 2022. Spoken to quite a few people. Lizzie Banks kept a little audio diary for us. We've got another few voices in there as well. But I was down at La Course this morning. It started quite early, 10 o'clock. And actually, it was a great race. There was a bit of scepticism about the course. Annemiek van Vleuten was not very happy that it was quite a short race. It was 96 kilometres. There was a long way from the climb to the finish. But ironically, it was Annemiek van Vleuten that made the race very exciting, because second time up the climb, she went really hard. It forced a split. Elisa Longo-Borghini and Lizzie Dagnan were there. Demi Vollering was there. Mariana Vos was there. And Kasia Nevyedova was there from Canyon SRAM. Yeah, so it was a really strong group and a terrific race. And it's funny, because in the last episode of the Cycling Podcast Femina, we had an interview with Lizzie Dagnan, where she talked about her frustration at lockdown, because she felt that her team Trek Segafredo were really getting into their stride. And they've been good since racing resumed. And today they were excellent.
Well, Dagenham's had a great week, hasn't she?
She's had a great week.
She won the Grand Prix Plouay, the Lizzie Derby, that was, wasn't it?
Lizzie Dagenham
and Lizzie Banks in the two up sprint there. I mean, when I heard that Lizzie had won, I did think it was Lizzie Banks.
And you saw Lizzie Banks, didn't you, as you were riding in?
Yeah, I was coming back down from the Col d'Aise in my Ireland jersey and my mask. And I thought about
you wearing
yelling
your mask.
Out.
I was wearing on your bike.
Yeah, I wore my mask when I got back into Nice.
All right.
I don't know why I did that.
No, you're right. You're right to do it, because actually in Nice you're meant to be wearing a mask on your bike and inside your car.
I didn't
know
that.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So I had it on, and I thought about shouting. But I thought a sort of weirdo masked man in an Ireland jersey shouting at some women cycling past might not.
Unless she realised it was you, in which case I'm sure she'd have been delighted to see you. She'd already been interviewed by television's Daniel Free, but could her day have got any better?
But it's nice to see that Lizzie Degnan for this. I mean, she achieved a hat trick of victories in the Plouay, and she denied Voss and Van Vleuten, who were going for the hat trick in La Course, and she really outwitted them in many ways. You can understand why Van Vleuten didn't like the course. I don't think it's anything to do with the length of the course. It's just that after the descent, you had like 20 km on the flat, nowhere where you can actually go away and make a difference. And she tried. She attacked with 2 km to go. She attacked on the red flame, and then she saw that the sprint was probably impossible to avoid. And then, in a way, Voss played it wrong in many ways. Lizzie Dane played it very, very.
Longo Borghini was kind of key there, because she'd been dropped. She came back. She went straight absolutely past them. Voss was forced to start. Yeah.
Great teamwork.
It was really, really, really good, and a really interesting race. Lizzie Dignan, as you say, has had a fantastic week.
I can't let this go without saying how wonderful it is that a Frenchman says the phrase "red flame" for Flamme Rouge on an English-speaking media outlet. I love this. We're assimilating Francois.
Are you going to be calling Richie Port Richie Dore?
No, but I mean, why La Flamme? It's the red flame.
The red flame. Anyway, then we had the stage one of the Tour de France. Yeah. And I can't believe you were able to describe the breakaway without mentioning that Cher, asking whether he'd be strong enough, whether he could turn back time, because he's not the youngest of riders. Well done for avoiding
those umlauts are causing us trouble here, aren't they, Michael Cher? Just on the mask, I mean, we don't want to make this the COVID Tour de France, but of course it is. It's the most unusual day on the Tour de France.
Well, I was sitting having a coffee, and a voice came out of a tannoy as I was sitting having a coffee earlier on. Here it is. There was something quite sort of 1984 George Orwell about that. It's funny. I mean, it's not funny, of course. Nice is a red zone. Coronavirus is running rampant here, apparently. It doesn't feel like that, I don't think.
I went down to the finish to record the bit of commentary we heard right at the start of the episode, the announcer saying that Christophe had won on the Promenade des Anglais. And having been kind of at home for 6 months without really going beyond my village and the nearest town, I felt unusually sort of vulnerable in a way. Everyone's wearing a mask, but it seems that the mask means that people are doing away with social distancing. The crowds were shoulder to shoulder, a couple deep, people standing on whatever they could to look over the barriers. It felt kind of like a normal Tour de France finish down there.
Yeah,
I don't know. I kept my distance from, and
we're on sticky ground there, and especially, I mean, I've been interviewed twice by the BBC about this Tour de France, and should it have been cancelled or what? It's never actually been mentioned or even considered by the French press, because I think we've been out of lockdown since May the 11th, so it's been quite a while now, and life kind of resumed almost normally, and I think probably the general feeling here is that yes, the COVID is still, the virus is still around, but we have to live with it, because you can't all of a sudden we can't stay in a bubble forever, and in a way the tour, and the way that the fact that the tour is going ahead regardless of what's happening is a kind of kind of collective national decision to say life must go, you know, the show must go on, and life must go on as well. And, you know, and the virus is there. We try to get, you know, to protect from it. But and the Tour de France being the symbol of, you know, of the, you know, national pride and heritage, not to hold it would be to admit defeat to the virus.
So we're saying precautions rather than paranoia, really.
No, yeah, sure.
Guess, yeah, culturally we come from, well, the lockdown in the UK, and we kind of have got back to normal-ish. But the social distancing aspect.
Been living in France for six weeks, and I was struck when I came here that I went to a restaurant for the first time in 5 months or so, and people are back in offices. 80% of French people are back at work, and for all the cases are very high in France, the government has talked about an exponential rise in COVID cases. Hospital admissions and deaths are not that high.
That there's actually 350 people in intensive care in the whole of France right now, which is not that many. I mean, I'm not saying that it's not going to go up. We don't know about that. But, you know, one thing you must bear in mind is that school resumes in France on Monday. And 100% of French kids will be going back to school on Monday. So in the same time, we have this wave going up. And in the same time, we have the kids going back to school, you know, parents going back to work. And that's also what's going to make the tour very different in many ways.
Well, we've heard from our audio diarist already, which will be in Kilometre Zero, the kind of the surreal nature of the opening few days of the tour. Before the tour, it was announced that the rule in place would be that if any team organisation had two positive COVID-19 tests, they would be asked to withdraw from the race or forced to withdraw from the race. Now, Lotto Soudal had a couple of cases among their staff, not the riders, but of course have started the race. Then we heard a couple of days ago that the rule had been revised, so it would only apply if there were two riders within a seven-day period who had tested positive in any team. They would then be withdrawn from the race. But then last night, our colleague Andrew Hood of Velo News wrote a story which suggested that with intervention from the French government, the ASO and the UCI decided that the rule would revert back. And so there's been a little bit of confusion about what the rule actually is when it comes to the number of positive tests within a team.
The teams have been pushing back against this rule, you know, asking whether it can just be riders rather than staff as well. A concession to that has been the promise of second tests to check for false positives. But there's been some confusion today about whether the teams are all really clear about what the rule is. So we asked one of our diarist Tom Southam, sports director at EF, about whether he was clear and whether his team was clear about what the rule was and whether they were happy with it.
I think we're pretty clear in this team with the rules and how it works. The last communication that we had was yesterday with an update from the organisers. As I understand it, the rules are set by the French government, which obviously trumps anything by the race organisers, and that's what we're following. I mean, it's pretty simple. The rules are what they are. I think we've gone to quite great lengths with the team to firstly not get any infections, which is sort of paramount to falling in with the rules anyway. It's less thinking about that than more thinking about keeping everybody safe and doing the right things to make sure that the, you know, we're not travelling around with risk of infection. So I'm pretty confident. I can't speak for other teams, but I'm certainly confident that in this team we understand how things are working and we're working to the best of our ability with it.
So that was Tom Southam, sports director, EF Pro Cycling. We'll be hearing a lot more from him and from all our audio diarists. They've all been sending in loads of stuff, and you'll start to hear some of that in Kilometre Zero on Tuesday.
We'll make use of it, however, won't we?
Oh,
some
for
will
sure.
Go in the regular episodes, some will go in Kilometre Zero. We may even make a Friends special from
at the end with it all. Yeah, and there's some great stuff in there, and some riders have really risen to the challenge, which is great. So I'm going to hear a lot from our audio diarists. One other thing we should mention before we go tonight is that our jerseys, which I sported on the Caldez today, the Cycle Podcast jersey made by Katusha, they're available. And each week, purchaser of the jersey will be automatically entered to win a €100 gift voucher from Katusha. So if you go to thecyclingpodcast.com shop and click on one of the jerseys to buy one, you'll be entered automatically into a draw to win a €100 gift voucher. And they're beautiful jerseys.
Well, I'll enter the draw myself because I haven't got my Katusha jersey yet. So
did you? You haven't got it yet?
No.
Oh, okay. Sorry, Francois.
What are you going to do in the Katusha jersey? Yeah. You've never ridden a bike.
Yeah.
I don't mind. I just want it. You know, it's a freebie.
Oh, dear. Right. Oh, well, we should wrap things up for our first episode from the 2020 Tour de France. It's nice to be here. I mean, I have to say, you know, all of us have, we've all been living these strange lives, and even going out for dinner last night was very enjoyable and nice.
Yeah, well, we're with our colleague Tom Carey from The Telegraph and Joshua Robinson from The Wall Street Journal. I mean, it's a very unusual Tour de France. I feel it was kind of unusual to see you, Richard, reclining on your bed in your hotel room. You sent us a picture to our WhatsApp group about how you were professionally covering the Tour de France.
But waiting for riders to send me their audio diaries on WhatsApp. This is very odd. Yeah.
Yeah, well, we'll cover the tour however we can cover the tour.
Next year it'll be back to the usual kind of hanging around team buses, waiting for riders to speak to you and them not coming to speak to you.
I'm not even sure of that. I mean, there's probably going to be one of the subjects we might come across in as the tour unfolds. But one of the big scares from my French colleagues and others is that the rules that have been placed, this year imposed this year because of the COVID, become the rule once the situation gets back to normal. Because, you know, COVID-19 could be a great excuse to take us away from the paddock, you know. So we'll see. But no, really, I mean, you know.
I have to say, though, I think teams are generally, they've been very good in recognizing that things are different this year and being quite helpful as well.
I agree with that.
So, you know, it's not going to affect how we cover the tour.
As you say that, Simon Geschke has just sent in a memo from today's stage, which we'll put in kilometre zero. I think the thing about going off in a tangent here, but the teams can all put out their media and that serves a purpose, but kind of someone has to curate a story and we tell a version of the Tour de France and other people tell another version.
I mean,
of
what
the Tour
we're doing
France.
Here is expanding on what we did at the Vuelta last year with when we had our two audio diaries, James Knox and Nick Schultz. And what we actually found was that they took quite seriously the responsibility of telling an authentic version of the race and actually were more open than they would have been had we been outside their bus sticking a microphone in their face.
Yeah.
And so actually, you know, I think that we're going to get some really interesting insights from writers.
But just beware of one thing, that, you know, not to get led into a situation when we actually could, the Cycling Podcast and whoever else, cover the tour as well from our beds at home.
Because
going on the tour, as you know, all the Giro means you won't taste the local wines and you won't taste local food either in the Giro, the tour, in the Vuelta, if you stay at home in
Well, I know it's
in,
difficult
in
for
London.
You to be in Nice. You're walking around holding your nose, but hopefully you're going to take us somewhere nice for dinner tonight.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll find something.
Some
don't worry.
Kind of Marseille influenced restaurant. Anyway, that's all for day one. Can we first of all just hear a quick bit from one of our audio diarists, Michael Morkov, talking about tomorrow's stage. Here's Michael Morkov from De Kuna Quickstep.
On Sunday, going to have a really tough stage already. And I think as a cycling fan and for everybody who's going to watch, it's going to be really extraordinary to have such a hard and decisive stage already on the tour's second stage. The other day we was out looking at the parkour, looking at some of the climbs, the last three climbs actually. It's going to be a really tough mountain stage, and it's going to be GC going to be already quite selected after that stage. There's not going to be much playing around with yellow jersey and breakaways in the start of this tour. It's going to be straight into the game of GC. That's going to be very exciting.
So that's tomorrow's stage, a really interesting one, which might certainly give us an indication of who's going well and who's recovered from the crashes.
Well, let's hope it doesn't rain and they all...
No,
it doesn't rain for our bike ride in the morning.
No, sunny weather is apparently, according to my phone, and we can trust our phones, can't we? Yeah. It'll be sunny all day tomorrow.
We don't want them coming down the other side of the Torini like the three of
Carvel
us in stilettos.
It's a very, very, very tricky descent, much trickier than 2 days.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. Well, we're going to play out with a song, Francois. I mean, you kept us entertained during the whole of lockdown with your weekly song.
I didn't bring my guitar. Yeah, no.
But a couple of months ago, we got an email from Barry Holloway who said, "You may be interested in our song written about the first Tour de France in 1903. It's called Giants of the Road. The band are called Dr. Octave. It was co-written and produced by Ben Hillier, who had produced albums for Depeche Mode, Blur and Elbow. Rich's ears are pricking up at Depeche Mode especially." That's
really?
Your era, isn't it? Well, that's your
that's
era.
Not really, yeah, not really, yeah, kind of neutral on Depeche Mode, to be honest.
But their horn section played with Prince for many years. I mean, Prince.
Yeah,
you don't
he
get
was
better
good.
Than that. Anyway. So, Giants of the Road. Because I've been thinking about how...
You know, Prince, he shot... he shot the first movie he ever made. He shot it. It was shot in Nice. So
there we go. Wow. This is almost like it's scripted.
But the thing is, I've been thinking about how the old nickname for the tour riders, Les Forcas de la Route.
Okay. Yeah, like Francois. You've got to settle, you know.
Mm. Les Forcas. De la route. The prisoners of the road.
That's
because,
right.
Albert Londres.
Albert Londres, yeah.
Yeah, he came up with that description.
We'll get back to it.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Good old Albert London. Anyway, he came up with Les Forçats de la route, the prisoners of the road. Well, this is Giants of the Road. The lyrics are fantastic. We're going to play out with a whole song here, but the lyrics, the line that really gets me is, "Put a drop of strychnine in the brandy, gulp it down with a vintage Hermitage." I love that.
Can we do that tonight?
So this is Dr. Octave, Giants of the Road.
This gigantic ride.